Writer's Gym Podcast. Build creative confidence and grow your writing life with Rachel Knightley and Emily Incan. Welcome to the Writer's Gym Podcast with Rachel Knightley and Emily Inkpen.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Now, in today's discussion, we're asking a question, and that question is this. What's your Wessex? That's an introduction that is going to lead us into a discussion about place and setting in creative writing. So, to kick off, anyone who doesn't know what Wessex is in a literary sense, Rachel, can you tell us a little bit about Wessex and where that term comes from?
Absolutely. Thomas Hardy reinvented a section of England that wasn't named Wessex the way that Essex is the East. We had Middlesex way back when. I used to live in it when it actually didn't exist. So I guess that's why it's quite relevant to me, because the first place I lived in England was technically in a county that didn't exist anymore. We'd write Greenford, Middlesex on our address and it didn't exist. Wessex was where Hardy set all his stories. It's his version of that part of England. And it was the place in which his stories happened for him. And a bit like Edward Thomas did with pre-war England, it's that slightly more English than English place. And in a way, what we're going to explore today is how every writer has got their sort of place. The way that I have a London that is my version of London, what's your Wessex is maybe a way into the world in which your stories happen for you.
Mm. Well, yeah. I actually lived in Wessex at one point. I lived in Salisbury, or Melchester, as Thomas Hardy described it.
Yeah, because it was sort of Dorset and Devon area, wasn't
Wiltshire,
it?
A bit of Hampshire, yeah.
Yeah.
And the names were changed to protect the innocent, I guess. So Casterbridge, yes. The mayor of Casterbridge, that's Dorchester.
Yeah.
And Wessex, it kind of seemed to symbolise in Hardy's work a kind of a lost or being lost sort of England. Mm. Because at the time he was writing, we were moving towards a more industrialised society, and his Wessex was very much a rural agrarian society. And so there was something more than just a place where the stories were set, that there was this kind of imagined, idealised England of that he felt we were losing.
Well, I wouldn't say idealised. A lot of his work is not exactly celebrated for being positive.
Or cheerful.
Overly idyllic.
This is true.
In fact, one might say the opposite of Hardy, but yes.
Yes, it's not always a comfortable environment.
The way that when I'm editing, I was talking about wanting my writing to be absolutely itself when it went into the world, that was the end point of editing. I think for setting and place, just like I want my work to be itself, I want my place to be itself, but more so. So there's an essence of Richmond in which I set Twisted Branches and some of the stories in my first collection, Beyond Glass. And it's got bits of real Richmond in, but I've very deliberately sewn them into a completely different alignment to the one that they're actually in. Mm-hmm. But I've got an essence of the place without being too wedded to the literal, so that I have free rein. I've changed things within buildings, I've changed street plans, but I think there is an essential Richmond in there. And there needs to be for me, or I couldn't have created it. Mm. So even when terrible things are happening and you've got characters who are absolute bastards, snobs, whatever you want to have them as, whatever the story needs, it's not idealised in that sense, but it's almost more so. It's a bit like when I invite people to parties and sort of, what's the dress code? The thing I've always said is yourself, but more so. Whatever makes you feel good. So if you want to come dressed as an elf, or if you want to come gothed up to the nines, as I usually do, it's because that is what speaks to you. And I think place and setting allows you to explore your version of a place, but more so.
Because everybody's version of a place is different. Mm. Everybody's experience of a place is different. Yeah, some people could live in the same town as somebody else, but their experiences of that town and how they see it and how they view it is completely...
Oh, gosh, yeah. And mine being my sort of Richmond noir that I've created for myself is the town that a couple of my friends grew up in, and they absolutely couldn't wait to get away. Yeah. But for me, as a teenager in Ealing, it was the pretty bit that the 65 bus went to. And buses will come up a lot in my Wessex when we talk about our own. But it was very real to me. Their experience is no less real to them.
Yeah.
But this is my Richmond, and this is what Richmond became for me.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something that's very real to me.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Emily, I mean, as a sci-fi writer...
Yeah.
I mean, is there a place in your work that is akin to Hardy's Wessex?
Okay, so I've got a lot of places in my world, and a lot of them are sort of a collage amalgamation of places I've been and visited. It's like characters are a sort of like amalgamation of various people that you know that you put together and make a new person from. And I guess a lot of the action plays out on Dex Island, in the Dex Legacy and in the novels. But I guess there's a city on SP714, which is the planet, called Jackrat. And I think that's where my imagination draws me as a sort of home point, as like a magnet, to the point that, I mean, in the books, Jackrat features heavily. It's a place where one of the characters is always stationed in a diplomatic role. I've got a whole other book that I'm working on, which is set in the same city at roughly the same time, but just a completely different location and point of view. There's so much rich sort of culture, and it's a culture smash. Mm. And I think that that comes from being born in London, and I moved away, my family moved to somewhere far less London, and I never really identified with it. And I expect it's like your friends who wanted to get away from Richmond. Mm. Like, I absolutely wanted to get away from this place and moved all over and then went back to London and felt a lot better there. I guess this place is sort of like that, but more, and with bells on and with sci-fi bells on, which are a very specific type of bell, I think. Mm. More like a bleep. I don't know how you would
with
say
bleeps
that.
On.
With yeah. bleeps on, exactly. Yes.
So your Wessex in that sense then is something that you've imagined, wholly yeah. imagined, or albeit with, you know, influences from places
yes,
on this planet.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I should say that the next podcast is going to be about world building.
Yes. Yeah.
And so we're going to talk much more about that concept, which is often associated with science fiction and fantasy writers particularly.
Indeed, yeah.
But, Rachel, I mean, there is an element also of world building when you are using a real world sort of city or place, isn't there?
Yeah. Something that always spoke to me very loudly was... in Lisa Jewell's work, in a couple of the books I've read of hers, early ones, there would be a view from a bus window. And I do that in Twisted Branches as well, in what I hope is a very different way. But the way that I remember reading Lisa Jewell's novels and what characters see through bus windows and the way that all of London is connected, that sense of it, is something I draw on and find absolutely fascinating, that every story you catch a glimpse of is happening, is just as real as yours.
Uh-huh.
And whoever you look out of that bus window at and pick them, you know, they could have been the centre of the story, but you're the centre of your story, and this thing's going on over there and that thing's going on over there. And the interconnectedness of all things, if we can jump over to Dirk Gently, never stops being fascinating and beautiful, that all our personal worlds, all our little worlds that we separately live in are connected.
Mm-hmm.
And that, when I was writing a short story cycle, in a way, that's the point, that you see the same events from different people's points of view, and you realise we're all as real as each other, that as true as your own version of something feels, other versions are true too.
Mm-hmm.
And that, for me, was very important, that place is really in the end linking characters.
Yes.
That the place is a reflection of a load of people and what they've done or not done with it. So that's very important to me. But what I also had forgotten until thinking about What's Your Wessex is when I was much younger and I started writing, it was all set within this same rural English town. And all of the characters were probably idealised versions of myself and my friends, because I was a kid learning about writing, and they all had horses and they all had these amazing lives. And it was just pure fantasising. But even as I grew older, I think I could still see that town in my head. And at one point I remember worrying, will I be able to write anything that doesn't happen in there? And I'd actually forgotten all about that until having this conversation. So I think maybe I pushed that town away, and maybe now I want to bring it back and see what it means to me now.
Mm. Yeah.
Because for all of world building being about mainly associated with science fiction, fantasy, it's how we live our lives. We build our sense.
All the time.
Absolutely.
Mm. Yeah. We build our own world around us no matter where we are. And I think that's absolutely true. You know, I mean, I have my own world in my head, but when I go anywhere, I have my own world in my head. I'm experiencing it as me. Yeah. And I think that's, yeah, there's something very profound and true and intrinsic and unavoidable.
Everywhere I go, damn, there I am, Ben Folds.
Exactly. You can't change you. Like, it doesn't. And that's why when you're creating characters, place is so important, because characters are of the place and the place is of the character.
Absolutely.
They are so completely intertwined.
So just like character is plot and plot is character.
Yeah.
We are linked with the earth beneath our feet.
Yeah.
And even when we're not noticing it, it's there. And that's something that comes up in creative writing a lot, is the five senses and our version of the five senses are how you let a reader into your world.
Yeah.
And the more of what we smell, taste, the way the world is around us, we have, the more we feel present.
Mm. Yeah.
So we've got a Wessex every single time, even if we don't know what it is.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do you think it comes back to that oft-used phrase, write what you know, where writers set a lot of stories in a single place? Is that an example of them writing what they know, do you think?
I see write what you know a slightly different way quite a lot of the time. There's a lovely quote that may or may not be Goethe: I want to tell you my stories to find out if they are true. Something that I've seen people do with that is hear write what you know and think it means you to start by being autobiographical. And I see it a different way. The most truthful thing can be phrased in a world that is full of flying pylons and where the plants talk to you, and you know you can still get the emotional truth in something that is as non-autobiographical as anything. But what you're always trying to do is connect with a truth. Write what you know. The way that I do that is to dare myself to write, to find out on the page what I know and what I want to say and what I want to develop.
Yeah. Mm. Find out what you know.
Write to find out what you know. That's the dare. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's very uncomfortable, I will say that.
But not as uncomfortable as keeping it in.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, you said the vomit draft was a pretty disgusting image last time. I see where I'm leading here, and there may be worse to come, but it's much more uncomfortable to keep it in. if it needs to get out, let it get out. You'll be a calmer version of yourself.
You will be a much better version of you at the end of that. It's unpleasant in the meantime, but boy, is it healing. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's the one.
One of the things that people say of Hardy's Wessex is that there are times in his novels where Wessex is almost like a character.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, think of Egdon Heath in Return of the Native, for example. Rachel, I mean, you've referred to your version of Richmond, your version of London. Do you see it in those terms? Do you see it as a character that you can manipulate or has influence on other characters in your stories?
I do. What I think I see with place is the way, if you imagine a really happy home situation and you're in the beginning of the scene, and actually there's a very good one of these in Leanne Moriarty, I think it's in her first book and I can't remember its name, but we can check. You feel like you're in this safe relationship, this safe environment, and then the guy says something to the woman that essentially reveals he's had an affair, and suddenly the whole place is different, and her experience of what is home to her, the place is entirely different. And that's something that's always been very important to me, is that for me, everything is point of view in the end.
Mm-hmm.
your
and that
relationship
can turn on a pin.
And it can turn on a pin that suddenly that setting that was a close friend is now this unknown, unreadable blank face. So the character does change based on how the people are relating to each other.
Yeah. Mm.
I think there's a really good example of that in Virginia Woolf, actually, in To the Lighthouse, where the family are visiting this lighthouse, and the first half of the book is their visits pre-war, and then we cut to their first visit post-war, and some of them haven't made it, and it's a very, very different feeling place.
Yeah.
So that's a kind of place feeling different based on the experience of characters, or the place somehow now feeling frivolous in a way that it wasn't before.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The secret that my book has, that you never find out quite what the main event was that caused all the ripples of what goes wrong between the people, you don't find it out until more or less the last page, or nearly the last page. It's different people experiencing different things in the same room over and over again. And if you take sort of, I was mentioning Edward Thomas earlier and the slightly post-war or pre-war feelings around silence and what it means to love something and fight for it, but know that it actually doesn't love you back. That silence in the world, place isn't person. And however much you love a place, it's the relationships between people that fundamentally mean whether you're safe in that place or not. And there's a coldness to that, that hello, old friend, you might say to your sofa, but if somebody comes in and threatens to stab you, the sofa's not going to do anything about
it.
Place is not your friend or your enemy the way humans are.
No. It's interesting how you say about different points of view, and a place could be completely different to, you know, like for everybody in it, like lots of different points of view. The same place at the same time could be multiple things. But there's The After Party. Do you know The After Party? The show. Okay, so on Netflix, very fun, silly show. It's a murder, and then they got to find out who it is. Every episode of season two, at least, was from a different point of view. But not only was it from a different point of view, it was different genres. So one character saw the entire event as a romance. One character saw it all as a noir detective, like investigation. Somebody else saw it all as very sort of as a Western style. And it was so cool watching it all play out, but all the way the characters interacted and the things they said, and like they just took their clothes, for instance, and just put a pin in them in one place, or like, you know, a slightly different, they did something slightly different with it that just like twisted the take on it. And I loved this because it just showed how this one occasion could be completely different to...
And every version is true in its own way.
Yeah.
From its own point of view.
And the detective has got to sort through all of this and all of these narratives. And, you know, all of them are false. They're not in a noir detective, you know, they're not a detective in a noir, you know, they're not in a romance, and they're not in, you know, but there is truth there.
Yeah.
Let's bring this back then to advice that we can offer to writers who are wanting to make a place, let's say, important in their story. So, Emily, how much place does someone need to put into a story, do you think? Is it just the geography, the buildings, the landscape, or is it more than that?
It's only important, really, if it's important to your character.
Mm.
The way I see it is you've got a character, they take a step, ripples are spread from wherever they stand. You need to fill in details as much as the ripples touch. Beyond that, nobody cares. So it's all about your character, and they are the centre of everything and their experience in this place at any given time. What shapes the place is important. And you should know that in order to give those places context, because otherwise they will not be true. They will not be whole. They will not be themselves. So you don't necessarily have to do this ahead of time. This is the thing. You can have your character take a step, spread ripples, work out where they are and why. And they are this person in this place. They have taken their experiences there. Now what is happening there? And how are they reacting to it? Then you get into what this place is.
Yes.
And this all sounds very woolly. but
I don't think it sounds woolly at all.
No.
Can I agree with it?
Yes, absolutely. Please. Yes.
I'm going to do that.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm absolutely going to do that in a couple of things, really. I like what you say about how essentially the place doesn't exist unless there's people in it.
Yes.
And something that sometimes happens is, particularly with beginner writers, it can be very tempting to start by describing the place.
Yes.
But when we're just floating and we don't know whose head we're in, we can already feel that kind of doesn't make sense. Now, it did for George Eliot, because George Eliot was living in a time when most people believed in an interventionist God who was an independent reality.
Mm-hmm.
We're much more subjective now. Literary fashion has gone along with that, that our principal reality is point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm in this room that I'm in now, I'm immediately looking at the bookshelves, noticing what's on them. Yes, they're my bookshelves, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
If I'd been an architect instead, I'd probably be looking at the shape of the room. I'd be looking at the ceilings, the joins where maybe a wall's been put through or something like that. It's what the character experiences that defines the place. So going back to the question, my advice to myself as a writer, that anyone who wants to dare themselves is welcome to join me in, is notice what's already there. If you've got a character operating in their world, the ground is already beneath their feet. There's
yeah.
already stuff around them.
Exactly.
Notice it, experience it through their eyes, their ears, their nose,
yeah.
because we have five senses and we do not want to limit ourselves to one.
Oh, smells are important.
Absolutely. And yeah. find the world through the body. Find the world through the five senses.
Yeah. Mm. And don't overthink what's beyond the point of interest. Because that in itself becomes procrastination. If you go into too much detail, if you follow the Warren too far,
mm.
you are tempting yourself to include details that are not important to the character.
Yeah. Mm.
You know, you can go too far. And that is a danger. All of, you know, this stuff needs, you know, like, you might know it, yeah. but does your character care?
And of course, in a first draft, go for it. Bring on all of the stuff that you might not need to know, because it's you telling yourself the story, as Pratchett put it.
Yeah.
But once you start going, what needs to be here, that's when it pays to think of the funnel that the reader experiences the story through, which is the character.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
What's important to them? What's going on for them? What do they notice?
Yeah.
There's a whole genre of TV programmes where place is particularly important to the programme and quite often not that important to the plot, I think.
Yeah.
So think of, well, books as well as TV shows. Colin Dexter's Inspector Morse, all set in Oxford. And, you know, I think there was probably a feeling that people were watching it
mm.
for the beauty of the surroundings.
Oh, and literature can absolutely do that as well. I mean, Tana mm. French, the way that her domestic noir and her crime fiction shows you, just brings you right into the location, often before you know whose head you're in. It's not that we don't want to be in that setting, it's not that we don't want that richness, but showing the setting first does not only belong to telly and film, it can absolutely happen anywhere.
Mm.
But just because we don't know whose head we're in yet doesn't mean we're not there, and it's just about finding that balance so that you are operating in a world and you don't see the strings, you don't see the writer going, I'm pulling this string because it's pretty.
Mm.
It needs to join yeah. up with the character and the plot. It needs to be there for a reason that feels comfortable. Because even if you don't know what it is that's making you feel a bit jerky, if something isn't quite working, the reader is going to experience it, even if most of them don't verbalise why.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Subscribe to The Writer's Gin by searching for us in your favourite podcast app and clicking follow, favourite or subscribe. To be informed the moment we release new episodes and to have access to all our past editions. And what about the place as either a threat or an opportunity to your characters? So, you know, a particularly harsh landscape.
Mm.
You know, we might set a story in the frozen wastes of northern Norway or something like that. So place becomes dangerous, becomes hostile.
But or it can also be a refuge. It's like, okay, so if you look at, you know, for a very present example, Dune,
mm.
Arrakis is hostile, but for Paul Atreides and the Atreides clan, it actually becomes the source of their power. and they use it, and they use the people there. They become local to the landscape, almost. They become of that planet. The previous people who were, you know, there were just on it. They were not of it.
Yes.
And that means that, you know, like, they considered it hostile. What Paul Atreides does is he goes into it. It's no longer hostile. Well, it is. It's a harsh living environment, but it is his hostile. It becomes of him. It becomes of his house. It becomes part of that identity.
Yes.
So, yeah, you can take a place and you can start out with it in one camp and then bring it into another.
Yes.
You can do all sorts of things in terms of character point of view. One great example of landscape and place is Left Hand of Darkness, when the main characters are escaping over the glaciers. And this is an incredibly difficult environment and difficult terrain, and it's horrendous. Like, they almost don't make it. There's a lot of close calls, but they are escaping to get to somewhere else, and it is a case of getting away from death to go into a dangerous situation. That's quite a complicated relationship with a location, I think. Is, you know, this isn't a nice location, but it's a necessary one to get away from something.
Yeah, and the plot question that I often offer people works really well for that, that the idea is, what does your character need to learn about the world, and how does your story teach it to them? That's plot. You don't have any of that without the place that you're in. Yes, yes, the antagonist is likely to be the person, but there's also a sense of community. There's also a sense of world rules. How do people behave? What are the assumptions about what you can and can't do? And place and society all are very linked in that. And how you change yourself becomes how you change society.
Yeah.
What change happens in you happens external to you.
Yeah.
So I want to think about another use of place in literature, and that is that we take a real place and then we add magical or fantasy elements to it. So classic examples would be Neil Gaiman's Neverwhere, the London under London, where
the
underground and the magical.
The angel Islington is indeed an angel, and all of that.
Yes, he was.
Then we have
Peter Capaldi.
Lyra's Oxford.
Yes.
And another one that maybe some of our listeners will have heard of is Colin Molloy, his Wildwood novels, which are set in a real Portland, but with an imagined huge magical forest just outside it. What can we say and advise to listeners about adding magical elements to real places?
Just hearing you say that just puts me on Discworld, because the whole point of why Pratchett works as sci-fi and philosophy is that it's so fundamentally human. He's got I know I've talked to you about this, Chris, but when I was talking to Nigel Planer about his novel, it's the sense of humour of the universe. It's the way that I experience it. That there is the author's ideas about our world, our human world, usually the country in which the author has come from specifically, but more generally our human world and our assumptions about it, and what people do and don't recognise in themselves, and what happens in their towns, countrysides, communities, as a result of that. Discworld is able to laugh at us while still absolutely respecting us and wishing us well. And the energy behind that always came across within the humour. It was laughing with as much as it ever laughed at, much, much more. And for me, that's what a place is always going to be. Like, Douglas Adams had it with all of space and time. You know, he knew exactly how idiotic humans could be.
Yeah.
But there was awe in it. There was love in it. There was a respect for the universe that we were definitely still laughing at. So those, for me, were important. But the magic doesn't have to be science fiction. It doesn't have to be magic realism. The magic can be, like I was saying about Lisa Jewell and looking through a bus window. There's a couple of her stories where important things happen, because in one case, in Vincent Joy, Joy sees what she thinks is Vince, her former love interest, with his child on his shoulders. It turns out not to be his child. I'm not going to spoil it beyond that. I have somebody doing what a couple of other Lisa Jewell ones do, where you see how people join up, you look through windows, you notice how connected you are to everyone. And for me, that's the kind of magic and awe that is very important to me in naturalistic fiction. I suppose I am motivated, it doesn't have to be everybody, but for me definitely, I'm motivated by the magic that is we are a community. My Richmond may be somewhere I enjoyed a lot more than a couple of my friends who lived there's Richmond was what they enjoyed, but they will enjoy something else somewhere else.
Mm.
And we are all connected to each other, and that can be terrifying, but it's also empowerment.
I think it's all about layers. I think it's like, there's your layer, there's the layer of your point of view and, you know, the point of view that you've been brought up with, your experience. Then there's the layer of, I guess, with things like Neverwhere, it's sort of like the layer you can't see immediately that you put on top.
Yes.
And it's like, it's the layer of possibility, the layer of invisible doors and slipping through time and layered worlds and those sorts of things. It's about not losing the essence of place, whether that's in your character's point of view and their experiences, or, you know, like, but adding a layer to it that is, the, you know, a layer of experience that goes beyond what readers will see, if you get what I mean.
You've actually reminded me of Wonderland, or more specifically The Looking Glass. That image of Alice moving through the looking glass, so she's in Mirror World and everything is recognisable, but it's all the other way around.
Yes.
When Neil Gaiman does London Above and London Below, it absolutely reflects our experience that a lot of people will walk past homeless people hiding in some level of pretending that they are in a completely different world and they don't even see them, and it's the only way they can deal with that reality. I suppose for me, Wonderland was about that what if of if perspective was different. And I think the reason that that particular landscape worked so well for readers for all these centuries is that things do not have to be exactly as we see them. Alice, Alice is a child. She is able to go, well, it's perfectly logical that something completely illogical can happen, because she's still able to not just go by social rules.
Yeah.
And it does all seem to be about taking something that is our natural world and noticing something that doesn't get noticed, seeing it in a slightly different way.
Yeah, reframing it.
Reframing it.
Yeah, adding, taking away, finding the bits you can twist and tweak.
And I guess in the end, the really scary thing about it is that one person's London and that other person's London are equally real, and that's the thing I always come back to. And again, I know it is all point of view, but realising that every character's opinion or experience is just as real as every other character's, that you're not the definitive version, and having place is a way of realising that, that you can be sitting on the same sofa as somebody experiencing a completely different reality.
That's quite deep, isn't it? Thinking about the absence of place, the kind of white room environment of something like Waiting for Godot, there is no description of place. We could be anywhere. Is that something that interests you as writers?
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
What you've oddly just made me think about is The Good Place.
Yes.
Set in what we think is heaven, and they're having a terrible time.
Yeah.
I won't say what the twist is, but it's probably pretty obvious from what I did just say. And how your assumptions so govern the place that you're in. And I suppose in coaching it, that's essentially what we're noticing, is what are our assumptions about what we can and can't change? Where do those assumptions come from? And the minute you notice them, their spell is broken.
Yes.
The magic doesn't work anymore once you question your assumptions. You become freer to make decisions. And the fact that Godot is set in repeated behaviour is relevant to me, is that maybe hell is the belief that you can't change something.
Yeah, that you can't grow. I mean, I always say that you want to aim in your storytelling to have, make characters that are so interesting that you could stick them in a cardboard box and people would still care what happens, you know? Like, that's the aim.
Yeah.
And I think I stand by that. You know, I like to think that, you know, if you are telling a decent enough story and there is enough tension between people, you could put them on a blank stage and people wouldn't need the trappings of that. I mean, audio drama is a great example of that. Mm. I mean, you know, people have listened to the Dex Legacy and said, it's such a vivid introduction to your world. And it's like, you can't see anything. And there's not even any, like, you know, exposition. There's no narration giving people a building up a picture. It's literally just dialogue. And even so, people are filling in the gaps. Mm. People don't necessarily need all of the prompts and all the rest of it. People are very good at filling in those gaps. So technically, just stick them in a cardboard box. No, place is very important, as we have been discussing this entire time.
But being place, very glib about this. Place is a great way of being stuck as well.
Yes.
That sometimes the idea of getting out of a place...
It's like liminal yeah. spaces.
But you are it. Your location can only change when you are prepared to.
Yes.
So that's another thing about setting everything in one place. If a person's circumstances change, their sense of that place does too.
Yeah. And then everything shifts.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a great point to end the discussion. Now, Rachel, we always end these podcasts with an exercise or a challenge. What have you got for us today?
The idea that we keep coming back to of how the same place can be heaven to somebody and hell to somebody else.
Oh, Milton.
Yes. Mm.
Paradise Lost.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep.
What I'm going to suggest people do is pick a place that is either heaven to you or hell to you and just go swimming in that for a bit.
Oof.
What about it is heaven or hell to you? Tell me how it feels in your body. Tell me how the things around you affect you, and then do that for 10 minutes. And then for 10 minutes, climb into the head of somebody in that same place who feels completely the opposite. I'm going to give a couple of examples that I know about in terms of heaven and hell. Because I can't lip read to save my life and am very short and wasn't great at loud noises, I didn't enjoy clubbing when a lot of my friends did.
Mm.
It was slightly hell for me because I felt like I should, which is always how you upset yourself, be enjoying it more or be the sort of person, it doesn't exist, who enjoys it more. And heaven for me, and I am so proud to acknowledge this, might be Waterstones in Piccadilly, where I could do, or might be a bookshop somewhere in London where I could spend the day among books and just enjoy myself, meet friends in cafes, do that kind of thing. So what I'd do is I'd reverse those characters. I know characters with the reverse experience. My partner can hear better in noisy places and is tall. That is absolutely fine for him. We have friends who feel that a bookshop is a party that they weren't invited to, that for educational reasons or associations with books, that feels as threatening as the other experience might have felt to me. So it's not better or worse, it's just different. Find your assumption of what is a wonderful, wonderful place or a horrible, horrible place, and jump into the head of somebody for whom the opposite is true.
I think someone perhaps in a helicopter, like the one that's just flown over.
I was going to say, my horrible, horrible place would probably be Tesco's supermarket.
Oh,
I don't like it.
Tesco specifically?
Well, Tesco's, Asda, anything that's in enormous supermarkets, I do not like.
What are the things about it?
The bright lighting.
Mm.
The expanse of it. I find it very unpleasant. I'm very aware of the bulk of things. There's lots. So I guess it's like, it sounds really pretentious, but the capitalism and the waste.
Mm. Yeah.
And there is so much. Sometimes it's very busy and you've got lots of noises and there's pressure to remember what you need and to get what you need and to make the most of the time there. And really, I mean, this is why I do online shopping, because I just go online, I search for the things I need, I say yes to add to basket, now please somebody else go and do the hell bit.
That's a really great example. I'm going to give a character example in one place.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to put myself in Waitrose.
Uh-huh.
10 years ago, when I was a terrible cook and felt ashamed about it, and where there was too much choice and you had to go around and I'd follow my list and I'd be worried about not being able to find things, not being able to reach the top shelf, the shame of not being good at cooking, the picture of who I thought I was supposed to be, and Waitrose would be shaming to that version of me.
Mm.
Now, I live with somebody who loves cooking. I know what I've got on my list. I also have fun with it. I feel safe with it.
Mm-hmm.
And Waitrose these days is just super fun because I feel like I'm making active choices. They don't have the horrible lighting. I'm pretty sure that comes into it. And I feel both safe and like I am in a position of choice. Mm-hmm. I no longer feel like it's pushing on me. I now feel like I can relax and expand into it. And it's exactly the same supermarket that it was 10 years ago.
Mm. Yeah. See, but I would, not the same. That's what I would do. My hell would be that. But then I would have to, you know, say, oh, okay, well, maybe this excites somebody.
Exactly.
This is a world of possibility.
Yeah. And you can do it both ways. With me, I thought this is the same character in two points in their lives, but similarly, or the opposite, you can then take the same place and have two different emotional reactions. But either way, it's a great writing exercise.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Rachel Knightley and Emily Inkpen, thank you so much for this little tour around Wessex and various Wessexes that either we've invented or are in the real world. Join us next week for a conversation about world building.
Whoop, whoop, woo!
Thanks very much for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Writer's Gym podcast with Rachel Knightley, Emily Inkpen, and me, Chris Gregory. If you'd like to learn more about Rachel and the Writer's Gym, please go to rachelknightley.com. To find out more about Emily, please go to emilyinkpen.com. And for Chris, go to alternativestories.com. We'll print all these links and more in the show notes for this podcast. The Writer's Gym podcast is an Alternative Stories 2024 production for the Writer's Gym. Production, sound design and editing were by me, Chris Gregory.